Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening and welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. My co-host, Red Beckman, will be rather quiet tonight, although I understand he has a live mic. He just got back from the dentist chair, so we'll include him in our opening prayer. Our guest tonight has been a very regular co-host with us here for the last 3 or 4 months at Walls in Our Minds, and that's Kurt McKenzie. Say hello, Kurt.
Hello. Glad to be on board again, Terry.
Thank you, and glad you're here with us, and really looking forward to your presentation tonight. Also, we have Dr. Kate with us. She's producing again tonight, and we'll be possibly jumping in with some comments later in the show. Let's open it up with a prayer, which is our regular thing to do here. We like to get God included in what we're doing. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this day. We're grateful for the opportunity to come on to the Blog Talk Radio and to speak with our listeners and put forth a message, hopefully, of truth. And we pray that you would guide us in that way and that your spirit would go before us in everything that we do. We really pray that our message tonight rings true with the folks that are listening tonight. And we just we pray that we catch the wave that you've got going, Father, because we know that your will, you know more about what we need than we know ourselves, and we ask for your spirit to intercede for us, and we're just thankful for your son, Yeshua. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, Kurt, this has been some time coming. I know that I've asked you many times what's the next step, and I know you've been formulating that in your mind, and we've been very focused on solutions and trying to bring forward the vocal local concept of people understanding what's going on out there and where the tyranny is happening and how it's happening. And we've done a pretty good job of laying that out, especially the way that rural America has been attacked. And I'm just looking forward to hearing what you've got to say. And I'm going to turn the floor over to you, Kurt.
Well, Terry, thank you so much. Yeah, you're right. I have been thinking about this for a while and trying in my own mind get together what I think is the next step. I think that the shift, frankly, from the idea that we're defending four dams to actually defending rural America was, a major one, because you reposition the battle not in terms of individuals or one community, but as a national campaign that, you know, also incorporates all aspects. So we're talking about ranching, farming, timber, suction dredge mining. All those things get pulled under that umbrella, and I think that's really the way we have to look for solutions here, is we have to work together. So I think that was a big repositioning of the entire battle, and I think that kind of positioning is extremely important. The next question is, what's the next step? And obviously, we've had the tremendous job done by Richard Mack, and for years has been pushing the idea of the sheriff and his 10th Amendment win with the Supreme Court. And obviously, that gained a lot of momentum. I think that, you know, the sheriffs that came to the Siskiyou County event on October 22nd, that panel of eight, certainly helped that move forward. And then that led, of course, or at least to have a step along the way to Richard Mack's vision of pulling together sheriffs from across the country in Las Vegas, which we've talked about in your show. And I think that's really a phenomenal result. I think the next step, the banner that needs to be carried forward from here on, in addition to this Defend Rural America, is the idea of the constitutional county. Now, we cannot have, we may not be able to have a constitutional federal government. It's clearly gone outside of the boundaries of the Constitution, seems to be openly ignoring it, and gleefully so in some cases. But we can sure have constitutional counties, particularly rural counties. And I think that's where the next step really lies. I realize that we're just barely getting going on getting all the sheriff part of this thing together. And as vital as and as important that is, you know, the sheriff is one person in a county. There's a whole team of people that need to be brought on board. And I think that the sheriffs have established the standard, and that should be the standard for everybody that's elected in the county. And so now I think that's the standard that needs to be applied to the district attorney. That's the standard that needs to be applied to the board of supervisors. That's the standard that needs to be applied to the judges and every other elected position in a county. Because if we can establish that standard and then those people work together as a team in combination with the people in the county, the activists within the county, and I'm talking about Granges and cattlewomen, cattlemen's, tea parties, all those various groups that are fighting the battle, working together, if they adopt that banner, I think we can go ahead now. And I think a lot of people have come to the same idea that we have to win this battle a county at a time. I agree with that. And having been part of the ROS Pro United We Stand America, which is organized by congressional district, I believe in retrospect that's a mistake. And I do believe that the thing that we have to do now is to start to think by county. And that means that we have to look at mailing lists by county. We have to look at elected positions by county. Everything has to be done by county in my perspective. And the counties that I think we need to focus on are the counties, the rural counties within the rural states. Get those back on a solid footing, and then I think from there we can move forward to having constitutional states, particularly the rural states. I'm not saying we don't try and get the other states on board, but certainly the rural states are the low-hanging fruit, in my opinion. And those come awfully close. I think they easily meet the two-thirds standard for proposing a constitutional amendment, and I believe they come darn close to having the three-fourths that's required to pass a constitutional amendment. So that being the banner, the question then becomes, okay, what is the Constitution? And I think this is where a lot of the debate goes on. And I've listened to a lot of this, and I've recently pulled together a presentation using the Constitution to Defend Rural America, which I just gave last Saturday up in Siskiyou County. And I believe that that question takes a while to kind of explain. We have, prior to the Constitution itself, the way I look at that is really, it's really not a document that talks about values or principles. What it is an organization chart for a limited central government. It really is not talking about the rights of the people. It doesn't talk about the relationship between people and their states or between, to any great extent, between the states and the federal government and then limiting the federal government. It is a document principally that defines the structure, the organization chart, and the duties of this limited central government. And I think to understand the Constitution, one has to then go back to the Articles of Confederation, which starts out as a Congress, a people, a group of people who meet representing the people at large, much like the United Nations was originally argued to be a meeting of ambassadors that talk over, you know, issues of common principles, which eventually became the Articles of Confederation as a formation of a structure once again. But it was pretty much a loose alliance of states. It wasn't nearly the strong central government that was in the Constitution. But it, too, is, I think, largely an organization-type chart. So what drives both of those? And I believe the step that happens before that is the Declaration of Independence. this is a document that talks about principles. And this is where I think that the heart of our country really kind of comes from. I believe those that say, well, it's not the Constitution, therefore it's not the law of the land, I disagree with that wholeheartedly. Because I believe that we are fundamentally a nation of principles first and foremost. So then you say, well, where do those principles come from? And I think that you and Red Beckman and others have been extremely good at pointing to the Magna Carta. But I think if you even go back further than the Magna Carta, in my opinion, and I've spent months reading this, is you have to go back to the Bible. You have to go back to the New Testament. You have to go back to Jesus Christ, in my viewpoint. And whether the audience believes he's God, the Son of God, or just a man, it really doesn't make a difference, because nobody denies that this individual lived, and that at age 30, this humble carpenter decides he can be silent no more. And he gets up. He clearly has a battle trying to decide whether he's going to go forth with his message or not, because he knows that he's going to be killed if he does. He battles it out and decides that it's more valuable to save the future of mankind than it is to save his own life. And although I believe that the teaching of the Christian faith has been corrupted, and I ask people, what do you think was, why did he die? I think that the typical answers that are given by the churches these days are the wrong answers. I believe the reason he died was he looked around at what was going on. And here is an individual who had no money, he had no military, he had no weapons, he wasn't hurting a soul. Why was he killed and brutally killed? And I think the answer lies not in that this was predestined, that this was God's role for him or any of that. That certainly is something that a biblical interpretation would provide. But I believe it's because of what he was saying. The miracles are not the substance of what of Christ was about. The miracles were only there to give credibility to his message. And what is his message? His message is that we are all the sons and daughters of God. We are made in God's image. And before God, we are equal in his eyes. And we have an individual relationship. And I think that it gives rise to this idea of individualism. No person or no group of people is superior to any other in God's eyes. And that we are there as equals. And that we're not judged by our parents, we're not judged by our race, our gender, or whether we're rich or poor. We're judged upon a totally different set of principles. And the basic principle is how we treat our fellow man, whether we treat our fellow man well or we don't treat our fellow man well. And, of course, we have the belief that in the fact that we are made in God's image, we are, in fact, God's children, is where I believe we derive our belief in the value of human life. And, of course, that, whether it's unborn or not, we believe that human life is different. We're not just naked apes. We're not just survival of the fittest. That we are something unique. We are of value. And each of us has an equal value in this relationship. And our judgment day is not going to be by other people, but we will be judged by the basis of how we act during our life. That idea changed the course of history. In 3 years, this individual has changed the course of history for the next 2,000 years. And in my belief, he changes that because of what he says. That principle, which we would take for granted today, I believe was revolutionary in its day. Nobody is preferred or has any title over anybody else. That, then, I believe, is the driving force that brings us to the Magna Carta. Because if you believe in this equality, then how can kings be preferred in God's eyes over anybody else? And I believe that there is a challenge that begins to emerge, the idea of, you know, that the kings are God's representatives on earth or predestined to be the right of the kings. And the people start looking at that and saying, hey, wait a minute. And they force the idea that government is going to be accountable to the people, because they're beginning to move away to that concept of the divine right of kings. We move forward then to the Declaration of Independence. And I think those words, we find it to be self-evident that all men are created equal, is a philosophy that Christ espoused nearly 1800 years earlier, simply expressed in modern terms. It was the revolutionary concept that is driving and has driven a good chunk of the world, certainly the Western world, for a long time. It is those principles laid out in the Declaration, equality, unalienable rights, and government of the people, by the people, for the people, government by the consent of the people. We've now moved one step further on beyond the Magna Carta, but now not only is government accountable, but government is to be of, by, and for the people exclusively. The people are the sovereigns, and the people are to define the government which they will accept. I believe that then leads us into the Articles of Confederation, and then ultimately into the Constitution. Although a lot of people put a lot of weight behind the Constitution, I understand quite clearly the role Alexander Hamilton brought into that, and I believe that there are some corruptions that are in the Constitution, but set that aside for a second. So we now have a Constitution that establishes an organization chart. And in the simplest terms, what does that basically say? We have a national government of limited abilities, limited powers. We, the sovereigns, we, the people, designate certain powers to the central government and no more. This is their box that they can live in. This is what they can do. Everything else we reserve to ourselves or to the states. Now, as we know, the Constitution is not accepted. It's not ratified. And in fact, what has to happen in order for ratification to occur is the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which you and Red Backman and others have talked about and helped educate me on. And if you look at the Bill of Rights, let's take specifically Amendments 1 through 8, what we have is an enumeration of the powers that we reserve to ourselves specifically. These are ones we're saying, we're not giving these up. These belong to us. They are unalienable. We want to make darn clear you understand that these are unalienable. These are our rights. These are our protections. The 10th Amendment says the central government, we want to also make it very clear that what we've enumerated are your powers, that's your box. That's your sandbox. We put a boundary around it, and we want to make it abundantly clear everything else belongs to us or to the state. In the enumeration of the individual rights in the First through Eighth Amendments, we then have the 9th Amendment, which says we want to make sure that everybody understands this is not the exhaustive list of our rights, our inalienable rights. We just want to make clear that these, for sure, you understand, are reserved. But, hey, we reserve everything else. So the 10th bounds the federal government. The 9th expands and leaves expanded out to infinity our rights and our powers. So if you peel them back and you look through 1 through 8 and you take a look at certain portions of these, you come up with this enumerated list of things that we reserve unto ourselves. Then we take a look at the 5th, 6th, and 7th in terms of just the part that has to do with trials and so forth and grand juries. And what you have is, I believe, if I recall off the top, the 6th talks about trials for criminal matters, for breaking the law, is to be trial by jury. The 7th, which Red Beckman has said is the most important of the amendments, says that in all other kinds of court cases, in other words, those of equity, those are going to be judged by common law. And then the 5th Amendment says we're going to also have grand juries. Now, what is that? Why a grand jury for certain crimes that are bigger than other crimes? And I believe the reason for that is that the bigger crimes are ones where government is saying, hey, you're messing around with the government here. You know, maybe it's you're not being a good citizen or whatever else. That's what kind of rises to the occasion of demanding a grand jury first. I think the reason for that was then you have a double layer protection for the individual. Because if the state's coming out after you, say for treason, for example, they have to get through two juries before you can be convicted. They have to get through a grand jury and they have to get through a trial jury. It's a double layer of protection. You think it would be the reverse, that in the case of these big kinds of crimes, it would be easier for government. But in fact, it's the opposite, because these are exactly the kinds of things where individuals speak out against their governments, and they are to be protected in their rights to speak out and to be able to push for change if they feel that change is required. There you have the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Now, what comes next? And the answer is you have more amendments. And I believe that in analyzing those additional amendments, we begin to see a corruption of the process. And specifically, I point to the 14th Amendment, the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, and clearly the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 as well. The 14th Amendment, the federal government decides that it is almost a nation. It can have its own class of federal citizenship. Up to now, the individual has been a citizen of their sovereign states. They are sovereigns. All of a sudden, the federal government says, well, we have citizens too. And what else does it say in that amendment? It locks in the debt. The debt of the nation during the Civil War has grown 43 times under Abraham Lincoln, the debt that broke that country and has never been repaid. We continue to pay interest on that debt. And the fourth clause of that amendment says, basically puts any review of that debt beyond judicial review. It locks it in and it protects the Rothschilds and the central bankers. Then the little fifth clause, the final clause, says that all these parts of 14th Amendment are to be essentially governed by legislation. Now, what does that mean? Because we now have declared there's this new type of federal citizens, and yet it's now going to be judged by congressional legislation. Essentially, it's saying that federal citizenship is not to be judged by the Constitution. Perhaps this is why it will lead to the first Civil Rights Act of 1871. So I believe we see a corruption there. You've talked in our show at some length about the 16th Amendment. Clearly, the 16th Amendment, the federal income tax, had been ruled unconstitutional in the 1890s. The argument being that the power to tax is the power to destroy, an argument that I believe that we can see is all too true. And then we have a Supreme Court decision after the passage that says, hey, that amendment did not add any new powers of taxation that just clarified the type of taxation that we could have. So if it wasn't within the power of federal government and no new power had been derived, then it gives meaning to the question, well, what do they mean when they say the federal income tax is a voluntary income tax? Why do we have, you know, the IRS pushing us? And I think this whole thing is an area where the people who are involved in the sovereign movement, you know, have analyzed this. There's real problems here with the 16th Amendment and this idea of the federal income tax. And I believe that also Red Beckman and others, you know, got involved in studying all the documentation allegedly behind the ratification, and found there has not been an adequate ratification of the 16th Amendment. Then we come to the 17th Amendment. Our founding fathers had very carefully constructed some balances of powers here. The senators would be, the House of Representatives would be elected by the people, and they would represent the people, and they would be in charge of the budget, and they would be the initiators of legislation. But the senators were designated by the state legislatures. They were not elected by the people. They were intentionally delegated by the states. They were essentially like ambassadors to the United Nations. They were ambassadors representing their states, subject to instant recall. And therefore, legislation, once it got through the people's house, had to get through the states. The states had a direct role in deciding what the federal government could and could not do. The 17th Amendment wipes that out and says, no, no longer. Senators will also be elected by popular vote. And then, of course, we have the Federal Reserve Act. And I believe that Red is coming back to the 17th for a second, has indicated that that has been landlines and that has not been properly ratified. So I think that we now have a question again, and exploring this question, what's constitutional, I see some problems in accepting these amendments as being constitutional. After that, we have things, we have legislation. Well, okay, we have all these laws, but are they constitutional? The Endangered Species Act in rural America today is being interpreted in a way that I don't think anybody ever understood it would be interpreted or intended. That act was passed to preserve major species like the bald eagle, which is a symbol of American, of our country, from extinction. It is now becoming interpreted to be a weapon of mass destruction, that it will destroy the backbone of our national prosperity. It's going after our water, our property rights. It's going after the timber, the ranchers, the farmers, the food production, the building materials. With free license, they're saying every other aspect, the Constitution's out the window, the property rights are out the window, all this other stuff, all these prior legislations are out the window, the Northwest Passage and all these kind of things, and your mining rights all out the window. That this little lizard has more rights than all of that put together. And then, of course, we have the other kinds of acts like the Aegis, the Equal Access to Justice Administration Act, that we're just paying people like the radical environmentalists to sue our government and force this kind of stuff. The Endangered Species Act is being interpreted now not to be that a species is going extinct or that it's even a major species. They're beginning to differentiate species on whether they have a blue freckle or a red freckle, or they come from the left stream and the right stream, which don't join two bodies of water. And they're being interpreted as being not that it's going extinct, but that, well, This particular species does not exist in its original numbers, in its original location, with its original habitat. By that very definition and interpretation of the Endangered Species Act, then all civilization is the enemy, because you cannot build a city without displacing a certain amount of habitat. So if this is the name of the game, and they're talking about now listing the buffalo as an endangered species, not because there's too few of them, but because they don't roam where they used to roam, then you're talking about the destruction of farms and ranches and towns all along five states or so, the Great Plains area, so that the buffalo can roam free the way you used to roam. Well, then we're going to have to declare the jackrabbit endangered species and wipe out Las Vegas, because Las Vegas has displaced the jackrabbit and the freeways are killing them. We're going to have to get rid of the Los Angeles Basin, because we certainly have displaced some lizards and some grasses there, and we're going to have to get rid of New York City, because we have certainly displaced something there, and we certainly have displaced some trees in San Francisco. It has gotten to be a weapon that's being used to destroy this country. And this cannot be tolerated. So the legislation has been corrupted, and it seems to completely ignore any constitutional limit. Now we get into executive orders. We have, I think, over 13,000 executive orders. The whole idea of an executive order is a questionable constitutional value. It was the first one was done by Abraham Lincoln. And we've been hearing from Obama, if he doesn't get it through by the legislative process, well, he just declares it to be the law of the land. He's now formed a rural council that basically takes almost virtually every agency of the government, puts them together into this new council, including Homeland Security, and says, okay, you're going to help to manage the rural area. They've effectively created a government, a brand new government in the form of this council that's going to do nothing but sit on top of rural America. There's so much for executive orders. Then we have this idea of judicial decisions. The Supreme Court has decided that judicial decisions are the law, that the accumulation of judicial decisions, this thing called jurisprudence, is really what counts, and that is the supreme law of our land. not what we think it is. They don't even go back to the Constitution anymore. They say, well, that's been decided. So by degrees, we get to a conclusion that freedom of religious expression means no religion at all. We wipe the Ten Commandments out of the support houses. We go ahead and destroy all the crosses. We begin even to desecrate the graves of the men and the women who fought for this country in our national cemeteries. Is that what's intended by our founding fathers? I don't think so. Now, in terms of Red Beckman's question of common law, in the decision Erie Railroad versus Tompkins in 1938, Justice Brandeis throws out the historical definition of common law. His decision reads, there is no federal general common law. Now, this directly refutes the Constitution itself, the Seventh Amendment. I am aware that what has been termed the general law of the country has been often advanced in judicial decisions of this court to control a conflicting law of a state. The doctrine rests upon the assumption that there is a transcendental body of law outside of any particular state, but obligatory within it unless and until changed by statute. But law in the sense in which the courts speak of it today does not exist without some definite authority behind it. Now, he does not acknowledge the people as an authority. The common law, so far as it is enforced in the state, whether called common law or not, is not the common law generally, but the law of that state existing by the authority of that state, without regard to what may have been in England or anywhere else. In other words, without regard to the Magna Carta and 1,000 years of common law. And he concludes, or one of the comments he makes, is the authority and only authority is the state. Now, if you take a look at Black's Law Dictionary, I have the 7th edition, it tends to go along with this opinion. It says, what is common law? The body of law derived from judicial decisions rather than from statutes or constitutions. In other words, the judges make up the common law. Is that what was intended when they wrote the Seventh Amendment? I don't believe so. If we take a look at Bouvier's dictionary and we look at a definition, it has a completely different meaning attached to it. And basically one that we'd agree with. It's basically a law that the people have evolved in a society reflecting the values of the people. This was the understanding of common law. Not that it's going to be controlled by the state or determined by the judges. And then we have this other layer, agencies that have been formed and seem to be all-powerful. The Colonel Edward Mandel House philosophy that we're going to just turn the powers of government over to these bodies and then we're going to let them make the rules, the regulations, and then they can act as the enforcers, the judges, and the whole thing, the judge, the jury, the whole thing. And under that, we have in the rural America, we have the 1600 permit. You have to get permission in how you use the water, your water that comes across your land. And water master fees that have grown by a factor of 7 times in 1 year. Or now the idea that the federal government can take a chunk of land the size of the state of Maryland times 2 that crosses 9 counties. These are big counties in Northern California, 5 of them in Northern California, 4 in Southern Oregon, and declare this is now going to be ruled by a group of stakeholders, including government agencies and radical environmental groups and a couple of Indian tribes, and completely displace the notion of representing the government. No longer do cities and counties and states matter. This is now a federal charter for how this is going to operate. All of these layers that have come after the Bill of Rights, in my opinion, become questioned. Is that really how we want to make our decisions going forward? So the question then gets back to what is constitutional, and how would a grand jury, for example, the jurors that are going to be making the decisions, how do they decide? I have so far talked about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 layers, that all of which could be interpreted as laws. I believe that when we talk about the term nation of laws, this is a term that I believe is generally used and everybody seems to acknowledge, including our movement. Yes, we're a nation of laws. Well, what laws? I mean, if I took the law books and I stacked them up, they'd probably be as tall as the Empire State Building. Nobody understands them. They're conflicting with each other. And we believe that a number of them are unconstitutional, certainly if not in their writing, then in their implementation. Our judicial decisions, jurisprudence, so those things that go thrown in top of that, and agency decisions and regulations, are those taking on the weight of laws? I think that if we try and move forward as a country, and we as a movement, say that first and foremost we're a nation of laws, at least laws as determined by these extra amendments on down through legislation, executive orders, judicial decisions, and agency regulations, we've lost the battle. Because we cannot possibly understand all those laws. The laws themselves are conflicting, and I think that they are, a good number of them are unconstitutional. I believe that moving forward, if we are to have grand juries and we are to have jurors who are constitutionally trained, that the thing that the people have to go back to is the following understanding. We are first and foremost a nation of principles and common law, which was the reflection of those principles. But principles first. And if we stick to those principles in the making of our decisions as jurors, I believe we're going to be guided down the right path. Now, no sooner did I come to a decision like that than I find that somebody's beat me to the punch, as usual. Thomas Jefferson, quote, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution." And let me underscore the final words, held to the principles of its constitution. I believe that has to be the guiding light going forward in our decisions as we, the people, begin to reassert our authority over our government and our country. And that's the only firm guide upon, I believe, which we can move forward. So getting back to the question, what is the Constitution? I believe it is first and foremost a set of principles. And among those are those principles which derive from a historical view going back at least 2,000 years. Into the idea that first and foremost that all men are created equal and that nobody else is to sit there and govern us, and we have the right to life, liberty, and property and the pursuit of happiness. All four, not just three, but all four of those things. So I think that what we have to move towards now, the sheriffs have got the ball rolling and they set the bar. Now we've got to pull and push the county commissioners, we got to pull and push the district attorneys, we got to pull and push the judges to also come on board with an understanding of what a constitutional county is and what the Constitution really means, and have to work together as a team so that when one person by themselves cannot a football team make, you can't just have one person running the play and everybody else in the stands. I think we have to get down the field, and not just that when we have our 12 people in the field, the other guy has 1,000 people on their football team. Nobody can go back to the bleachers, not for the rest of our lifetime. Yet everybody gets on that field, everybody works together, everybody holds their constitutional standard. I believe that we have the reservoir of those values residing in our rural counties, and I believe this is where the war has to be engaged, and this is where we can win. Back to you, Terry. Terry, are you there? I can't hear you if you are, Terry. How about Red? Are you there? Can you talk?
I'm here, Kurt.
Okay.
I didn't know you were going to throw it back at me, and I had myself muted. So.
Well, that's kind of my opening thoughts on where we need to go.
Stan in our chat has made a couple of comments. One, he talked about the regional regulations being a ripoff, and he's also talked about apathy of the urbanites and how they just seem to care less about all of this. And I think it's important to bring forth the idea, the same as happened back at the time of the Revolution, and that is that it didn't take a majority. And this was my major complaint with the book 5,000 Year Leap. He came out with a comment about two-thirds of the way into that book that it takes a majority. And I'm like, you're nuts. I mean, all of a sudden you've been talking about all these natural laws, and and all of a sudden you abandon the whole concept of individual right and the fact that a very few people with the right amount of passion and courage are the ones that generally control, not the majority. And I just don't think we need to get caught up in the fact that we've got to sell, you know, over 50% of the populace on this concept or expect that they're going to do anything about it. That's not how this country was formed. So, you know, you've laid out the principles and the precepts, and we've talked about them a lot here on this show, and you know, others that have come onto the show have actually laid them out in better detail than we generally talk about them. But these principles are critical, and if we can just get, you know, a reasonable number, 10% would be a lot, to pick up these principles and to really push them forward in our counties. Our counties are not controlled by the majority of people. Our counties are controlled by a select few that stand up, that get off their couch, that stop watching American Idol and do something. And I just believe that's an important point to bring out at this point.
And I agree with you, by the way, on that. I do believe that, you know, you don't need to have that majority. You and I have talked about this before. This, in my opinion, education is, you know, is a good thing, and we're going to persistently do it. But at some point, just education, you know, and ongoing, you know, you can get in a trap of doing nothing but reading and studying and get upset, but there's never any action. There has to be action, and I think the action comes upon those who are awakened, they understand enough, and they get motivated to start working together. The action component has to happen, and it can happen. A remarkably few people that really get it and work together as a team can achieve amazing things.
Well, at this juncture, the question is, what does an organization look like that will be effective? And Red and I have had this conversation, you know, many times, and that is that, you know, if you get a top-down group and form some entity, and everybody were to come under that umbrella, it would make a very good target. And it seems like we're better off to be a little bit spread out. And you talk about your three C's, the communicate, coordinate, and cooperate. I'm kind of wondering, you know, what the picture of that in your mind looks like.
I really firmly, having run the California State Chair for the Ross Pros United We Stand America here in California, where we had a vertical organization of 40,000 members, I've seen a vertical organization that really begins to look awfully political. You can have a few people come inside, and they are masters of it, and they can destroy an organization's unity. I'm a big proponent that that's not the way to go. The Tea Parties have emerged as largely local, small entities, but on top of that, we have the Cattlemen's Association, the Cattlewomen's Association, the Granges. We have all these other organizations that exist, whether Rotary, Second Amendment, mining associations. They go on and on and on. I think that what has to happen is actually you need to have the hub of the spokes of the wheel. The organizations themselves have to maintain their own individualism, their own character, their own leaders, their own budgets, their own websites, their own email lists. But somehow that has to all kind of be tied together in a way that's voluntary, but brings people together who are inherently shared the same objectives. And that begins with communication. That absolutely has to happen.
I didn't close the chicken house. Oh, I did shut it too.
I hear somebody in the background there.
Is that you or?
No, that's somebody.
I know she's
somebody else.
Kate, you might need to mute whoever that background noise is coming from.
So I think what really is needed right now, Terry, is something like Defend Rural America, and I know that there's probably a few others, that really works as an umbrella organization, has no intention whatsoever of becoming a vertical organization or to try and dictate to anybody, but an organization, a small group of people that instead lead by example. If they have strategies, they put them out there like I'm doing here. information to convey, like I do on the Defend Rural America website. You form alliances, and you begin to have a communications backbone. That's what I think where we head. The small groups have this guerrilla warfare kind of thing has its advantages, but we generally have groups that are understaffed, undermanned, not necessarily people who have ever managed anything before, but, you know, they're motivated, they have a lot of energy, there's a lot of good things there. But I think there's a tremendous amount that will come out of synergy. And I believe that some of that can be done. You know, some organizations will never get it. That's fine. They go ahead and do what they want to do. But those that do get it, they do understand that the way that we have to take this country back is to work together. They come on board. They preserve everything they've got. But they now are tied in, connected, and working together with other people. I think that's the way we have to go. So getting back to the county theme, though, I think is that we have to, the first place to start, in addition to having an activist core, is we have to basically get that core has to begin working to educate and get on board and make sure that we have commitments from the entire elected body within a county that looks that, you know, they take a pledge to the Constitution, probably never thinking about it or knowing what it is, an oath to the Constitution. I think they need to be awakened as to what that means, and they have to declare that that's what they're accepting as their duty, as the sheriffs have done and are doing to their, you know, to their credit. They're moving forward on this.
Well, I'm ready to go. that's all I can tell you. I've told you this before, and I know we don't want to get into all the details of things here on the show, but I know that we've got a lot of people who are ready to step forward and help coordinate. You know, they're listening. They've got their ears on, and you know, I've probably got half of this country covered with at least one person in every state. Of at least half of the states that would be glad to help this communication and coordination happen, and I don't know any other way to put it than to say let's do it, let's go.
Just so people understand, it's already happening because I'm forming alliances. People are coming to this message. They do understand the power of this. We've added on, you know, four organizations here in the last 2 weeks. We're now having a mailing list that we're, without giving away our own list to each other, we have a cooperative way to work with this. And everybody now has, you know, the leaders of these groups can not only communicate within their own groups, but now they can communicate to other groups as well, so that the ability to reach an ever larger group of people is there. All it takes is people who either have organizations or are willing to organize a communication team where we begin to work together, and all of a sudden the communication grows to being tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to hopefully millions of people that can be reached. Because ultimately, no matter how smart we are, no matter how many strategies we have or how well we thought this thing through, if we cannot reach a large number of people, you know, we're basically talking to ourselves. And so we have to be able to get beyond that. And people who like to help this with the Defend Rural America project, as I continue to develop and expose, if you will, more of these concepts, you know, let me know. Just contact me or Terry or Dr. Kate, you know, and Red. They're all big supporters here trying to do this. I think this is where we can win. The whole question has been is where do you get traction? And having been a person who wrote a book about the monetary system, because I know that's the ultimate obstacle, is the Wizards of Oz that are behind the screen, you know, you can't get traction because it's somehow people still can't quite grasp, but they're stealing money out of your wallets and purses, and they can't quite figure out how to do anything about it if they do. So you got to go where people have, they live, where they have problems, they're about to get kicked out of their homes, they're highly motivated. That's where you do this, and it's happening all across rural America with this Endangered Species Act and now the wetlands, you know, the SACA case that's in front of the Constitution and so forth has gotten so egregious that there is a lot of motivated people out there. We just have to be able to find out who they are, get them hooked in and connected, and start helping each other.
Well, I sure wish Red was feeling up to jumping in and speaking tonight. I think he would contribute a good amount to what you're saying right now. And I'm a little reluctant to say some of the things that I've got on my mind because I don't want to tip some hands. Can you give us a little bit of an update as to how things are moving forward with the Jenners and folks like that? What kind of action is being taken by some of these people that that we've had on here, that we've talked to about these issues, and given them some ideas as to what to go and do? Maybe you don't want to give specifics. Maybe you can, but I think it would be good for the listeners to have a little bit of an idea as to exactly what's happening on the ground in some of these local communities.
Well, I think that the efforts are working, and you know, the battle goes on. I mean, there's no clear win here. We're still leading to a situation where Salazar is supposed to make a decision about the dams here shortly, and then that's supposed to go to Congress for ratification. But I tell you something, all of a sudden we had Salazar coming to Medford, Oregon to make a presentation and appearance here just last week. And, you know, all of a sudden people are beginning to, you know, realize that there is a big effort here, that the lion's been let out of the cage. And this isn't business as usual anymore in Siskiyou County. And I have to give the people of the Siskiyou County all the credit. They have, their lives have been turned upside down. I mean, you know, I was up there for 3 or 4 days here just recently, staying with one of the ranchers up there. And, you know, their life is normally you get up and you go grab, you know, a couple dozen bales of 120-pound bales of hay. You put them in your pickup truck and you go out there and you feed them to your cattle and you make sure your cows are okay and your bulls are okay. And, you know, you do this a couple times a day and you're trying to figure out how to make sure you get your water and get it, you know, irrigated right. I mean, their lives are plenty full as it is, and all of a sudden they're dumped into this whole problem of trying to defend themselves against a hostile government. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, so all of a sudden their lives are full of meeting here, meeting there, meeting this, you know, telephone conference there. I mean, there's, I don't know, most of the people I deal with are going to the 3, 4, 5, 6 meetings a week on top of trying to run their ranches and their farms. And as everybody, you know, knows, but probably has never lived in that environment, you know, cattle don't, you know, go home at night after 5 p.m. And, you know, they don't go home for the weekends or disappear for vacations. You know, these are people who deal with a job that's 24/7, 365. And all of a sudden the burden is on them to try and figure out how to preserve, you know, their part of the American dream. And it's crazy, but they have stepped up to the plate. And they are living under personally very stressful lives. But they are what is remarkable as a result of that October 22nd launch, and they get all the credit, they're working together. And all these different organizations have come together. They're working together. When it came to the Jenners and they, Noah came back knocking, you know, things began to, government came back to try and pursue this a little further, you know, to hold a meeting. All of a sudden, all the leaders of all these groups, plus a good chunk of the community, showed up at that meeting too. It wasn't just the Jenners that showed up. So they are working together as groups of people. They've got their phone trees. They have an alert. Sheriff Allen Mopey, you know, no federal agents are allowed to trespass on people's properties anymore. I mean, they are really doing everything they can do and more to fight the battle, and I believe that the example to be set for the nation is Siskiyou County. And things are beginning to take traction. I think that stepping this up from the constitutional sheriffs to the constitutional county is the next step. I believe fully utilizing the tools that are in the Bill of Rights is part and parcel of that next step, and these things will happen.
I'm wondering if you've contemplated what's going to happen if the feds force their way through, you know, to continue down this path. Where can this lead to if they go in there and try to blow those dams? If they try to to manhandle the situation and not listen to the locals.
Well, you're dealing with people that fight fire with fire. You know? But let me put it this way. The Board of Supervisors up there, to their credit, they've already sent a letter to Salazar saying, if you move forward on this, we're going to sue the federal government. The county has already put the federal government on notice. You know, and you know, things like, you know, all these pieces come together when you start working together and listening to each other. You begin discovering these miracle things. You know, here's Sheriff Gil Gerbertson in Josephine County, Oregon, doing his own analysis, and who knew, but he wrote this excellent 13-page white paper on really who has jurisdiction over public lands. And the answer is not the Fed. It's not what you think it is. And so I think that a great awakening, kind of like a lot of people who are in the sovereignty movement or people who are in trying to reform the monetary system, you're looking for this kind of an awakening process to occur. This awakening process is happening. And I believe that once the people really fully do understand the Constitution and all of its ramifications, and I'm talking about things like jurisdiction, who has jurisdiction over public lands, getting that clarified and beginning to challenge and question, make them prove it, you know, I think that those kind of things are going to go a long way. So there's a lot of spine, I think would be the word, in Siskiyou County, and I think they can be a spark that leads the way, if you will, to counties. And certainly I know that the sheriffs are working together up there. It's not no longer just Siskiyou County. They have 8 sheriffs came to that panel. I know that people like Glenn Palmer and John Opie and others have expanded the list of sheriffs that they're communicating with, not just in, you know, throughout Northern California, Southern Oregon, but they're expanding into Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. I mean, it's amazing to happen. Sometimes you can't see it. It's like a tsunami, but it is happening. There is an awakening coming here, and no longer will people just be pushed and shoved in and intimidated into things that are not constitutional or lawful.
Well, now, I'm kind of curious as to how your involvement with Walls in Our Minds here has maybe impacted, you know, the Defend Rural America concept, the whole thing that you started out with, the Silent No More publications. You came to us a few months back, you know, back last fall, and seems like there's been some transition, that there's been a lot of learning, a lot of incorporating things and ideas together. And I'd just kind of like to get some feedback from you as to how you feel about that now.
Well, I think it's been tremendous, Terry. I mean, you know, you and Dr. Kate and Red are to be absolutely congratulated. You know, you guys came on board this program big time. I made 100% commitment to it. You know, I don't know what's done to your audience to keep hearing more stories about Siskiyou County or not, but you've stuck with this thing. And, you know, the reality is your show has become, in my opinion, the leading show here. It is the show where we're getting the people who are on the front lines. I mean, we're not talking about people reading this in books. You know, the people who are being intimidated, the people being pushed off their land, the people who are analyzing the science, all the various aspects of this story that we have been, that you've been developing on your show has been the fulcrum of communication. And if it does nothing else, we listen to each other as guests and we learn. And that interchange, you know, has happened. And the fact that it's actually broadcast, so much the better, because other people are in the inside listening to this whole project evolve, and hopefully they're going to jump on board with this if they haven't already and begin to implement some of this in their area. So, you know, your show, Terry, and Walls in Your Mind and your support of Defend Rural America has been a tremendous help.
Well, we want to do more, and I think we've got to. I don't think that's going to happen just by expanding this show. I believe we've got to really reach out to these other groups, and especially groups that have good-sized memberships and mailing lists and that sort of thing. And I believe, I don't know how much more we can do here without spending a lot of money or something on marketing this show. And I I just believe that it's going to be, the time is going to be, it's got to be spent on the phone and in the emails, and there's got to be a lot of communication. And yeah, Kate's talking about server and ideas. And Kate, why don't you jump in this conversation and contribute here, because I think you've got some things going through your head that need to be shared. Oh, come on, Kate. Yes, jump in here. I just believe we've got to one person at a time's got to do a lot. You know, there's never been a monument erected to a committee. I don't know if you've ever heard that term or not, but it really is going to take all of us as individuals to really get to work. You know, you can't even wait till somebody tries to tell you what to do. You've got to get on the phone. You've got to build relationships. You know, 80% of the people out there will never make a positive change in their life without being in the context of a relationship, and only 1 out of 20 of those 80% you know, have a close accountability relationship, and which means we've got to build those relationships. And that, you know, you and I have been working on that, Kirk, and I appreciate your friendship, and I'll just tell you that straight up. I've come to trust your judgment, and we've got to have those kind of trusting relationships across the way. And it's also the only way that we can really keep from being infiltrated. If we have a lot of new people come to the table, they really need to come in by way of somebody that you know, somebody that's known them for a while. I think that's how we've got to spread this and build the network of communication is one-on-one. Am I wrong, Kurt?
No, I agree. It has to be trusted individuals.
We've got a number of people in our chat. Kurt, you don't watch the chat, do you?
And no, but I can dial in if you like.
Well, I'm just letting you know that a lot of our people, we've got guys that were sitting out there as a guest and not signing in that have come into the chat here in the last 10 minutes and have all been saying, you know, I mentioned about Red Beckman creating a lot of monsters, and I'm one of them, especially when it comes to understanding about the juries and the Seventh Amendment and that sort of thing. And I made a comment about that in chat, and we've got people jumping in here saying, you know, I'm a red monster too. And they understand totally what I'm saying, that when people begin to understand what we've got to do, particularly when it comes to judging the law as people, when they begin to understand that, there's just no going back. There's no turning back. It's like once the eyes are open and somebody's on board, all of a sudden they start seeing an incredible amount of corruption around them and deception around them. And we've got to continue to grow that. And what I'm saying is that it takes a one-on-one, and you can't waste your time with people who aren't listening. You know, if you've got somebody that's your brother or your sister or your cousin or you're somebody you work with and they're not listening to you, don't waste your time. Go find somebody that is listening and bring them to the table. You're getting some compliments in the chat room, Kurt. I just want you to know that people are talking about how they find you trustworthy as well, and we appreciate you here, and that's important for you to know. Kate, I'd still like for you to jump in here because I know you've got some stuff you'd like to share. We've got a friend of ours that's in chat from Alaska. Gene, if you would call in, I would love for you to give us a report on what's going on up in Alaska. If you don't mind calling in, I'd love to be able to visit with you for a few minutes. Actually, the phone lines are open, so anyone that wants to call in and get involved in this conversation and maybe ask Kurt some questions, I believe he's prepared to to respond. So anybody that wants to call in, let's see, what's our call-in number is 347-838-9176. So anyone that would like to get a question in or a comment here or make a suggestion, please join us. We need some more situations to be reported to us as well. If somebody's got
a
situation,
I'll jump in right now.
Good.
I'll jump in, Terry, for a little bit. Good evening, all. Can you hear me?
I hear you.
I can hear you, Kate.
Yeah. I think as this awakening happens, we've got to avoid the situation where we're just constantly putting out fires. And Ashley have a pretty organized approach. And if you take almost every article of the Constitution, there should be those fires going on in all parts of the country in terms of us working on them. Like, it just occurred to me on the Siskiyou County, I think that is definitely the place for protecting rural America. And, you know, Terry, you were talking about the server that you have and beginning to start organizing these efforts. I think that's extremely critical. I think that efforts in protecting rural America could benefit from a civilian science corps, basically scientists who really develop the materials to really counter what the feds are coming up with. And not just through the administrative process, but technically, because there's a lot of opportunity. I also think that, you know, I just put up an article just a couple of days ago on the 16th Amendment and the Federal Reserve, and there are spread out efforts all over the place, but we've got to get that going again. You know, Red Beckman ran around for many, many years, and the information that is available, and even in the IRS's own handbooks, is astounding. There should be nobody who is paying taxes right now, and there should be an effort to really keep going on that. Juries, that is another area. And underlying all of this is the article that Chuck Baldwin just put up of what Ron Paul's detractors reveal. And one of his central themes is that we don't know the Constitution. The quote-unquote conservatives don't know the Constitution. And, you know, there are a million things to do, and there are also a handful of strategic things to do. And how do we create that balance, and where are those battles to be initiated and so forth? It's like needing to create a number of fires that the government has to respond to, but all over the country. And like I say, it's, you know, there are a million things you can jump up on. And there are problems with, quote, organizations. Now, you know, the veterans marched on D.C., which was just marvelous to see that a few days ago. And yet there are always people who are trying to lead that movement. If you remember J.B. Williams trying to, with the Patriots Union, trying to steer that and then, you know, ending up fighting and undermining everybody else. There's the Article 2 group that is working right now on ballot challenges, which that needs to continue. So my question is broadly, what are those strategic items that we need to work on and generate the action all over the country? Because it is impossible, especially financially now, for everyone to contribute to every effort and or to physically be there working on something. What are these things that can be done? And I'm thinking of the resource that you have, Terry, a server that could be, you know, kind of a focal point for a lot of this effort. The sheriff certainly should be linked in with all of these issues, every single one of them, including taxation, including, you know, eliminating the federal control over our natural resources, you know, protecting our rights to make a living off the land and so forth and so on, and protecting people against, you know, unlawful seizure of homes and records and so forth. So I wanted to jump in there and both say, yeah, let's get going on these things, and secondly, let's not throw the kitchen sink at everything. What are those strategic items? So I see that we have
a few callers
here.
I took a shot at that. That was the whole purpose of the YouTube video called How to Take Our Country Back.
Yep.
And it goes through and lays out, I think, a strategic foundation for what that overall strategy. And my mind has not changed on that. If anybody has not watched that, they should go watch that, because it addresses exactly the question you're asking in terms of what is the strategy. Because I agree with you, part of our, you know, 90% of our energy is dissipated by trying to do last-minute resurrections of things that can't be saved. We wait too long. We have to go on the offense, and there has to be a game plan. You can't chase everything. And I've laid my ideas out on that in that YouTube video. All my ideas are out there. There's not a whole lot of videos, but every one of them packs a punch, and they all mean something, and they all work together to help to answer that question. So you can get my perspectives on it anyway by going and watching that YouTube video.
Yeah, and we've heard also you go over that again tonight and lay out some other issues. So I think those are excellent. I'm going to get back to the switchboard now. We've got a few open calls. I'm going to make them live. So I'll be right here in the background if you need me.
Area code 907, you have a live mic.
Hello, Terry and Dr. Kate. This is Gene Brokaw.
And, good evening, Gene.
Good evening. I'm certainly happy to be on your program. We listen a lot, but normally don't log in unless there's something that we really feel is important, and this is most certainly an important subject.
Well, Gene, give us an update on what's happening in Alaska.
Well, right now we're working on trying to get Ron Paul the majority votes in this state, and we hope to be very successful in that. Our vote takes place in March 6th, and we're working on getting the word spread as far as possible. I'm hearing a lot of umbrage about Mr. Obama's gift to the Russians of three of our islands, which are very oil-rich, and I'm not at all happy about that, and there are a lot of others that are very upset. And he did not even have the courtesy of contacting our state officials before he made that choice. And of course, this is unconstitutional, and we need to find a way to stop that, among many other things that he has done.
Doesn't that require congressional approval?
I'm certain it does. This is another of those things that he's just taking the power away from the Congress, just like all his appointments of czars and a number of other things that he's doing. And look out for
UN. Were those islands controlled by the feds or by the state of Alaska?
They are part of the state of Alaska. They are not federal control. They are part of the state of Alaska.
How can he give away what he doesn't own?
Yeah, Margaret just told me that three of the islands are part of the state, and the others are not.
Yeah, that was when we bought Russia, or when we bought...
I'm going to put you on the speaker so she can talk to.
Hi there, Terry.
Good evening.
So actually what I've learned is that we have a set of islands. Actually, they're in two different parts of the water. There's, I think, like three of them that are actually part of the Aleutian chain, and they're a little farther out, so you don't always see those when you see a map. And those were the three islands that were part of the purchase from Russia. The other two islands, three, whatever. Anyway, they're up farther, way up north, and they were basically discovered by a couple of sea captains in the late 1800s, and they were then, I guess, I don't know, whatever the captains do, if they go take a flag and say, you know, I take this land for the U.S. or whatever. But anyway, so that's how that came about. And those islands, actually in that part of the sea, have a lot of oil. And the bad thing is, if Russia does get their hands on those islands, the first thing they're going to do is plant the drilling wells out there, and they'll be taking all that oil. And here, you know, in our state, our hands are tied so many times that we just, they won't let us get out there and drill.
Yeah, they won't allow us to develop our resources in virtually any way.
What
so anyway,
state
that's all
legislature,
I
mean. What's the state legislature doing about this?
At this time, I don't know.
They're trying to influence the federal government to allow us to start development, but it's falling on deaf ears.
Well, according to our resident hydrogeologist, the oil would be owned by the state of Alaska, not the feds.
That would be true. But
so they don't have to ask the feds or persuade them or influence them. They have to demand what is their right.
And they have not been doing that. Unfortunately, the state of Alaska is not a true state in all senses of the word. The state constitution was written by Chicago lawyers, and really we're still a territory, even though they call us a state. Also, Hawaii is in that same not too favorable category. So we are pretty well hamstrung by the Fed from doing anything of our own.
What's the Tea Party darling Sarah Palin doing about this?
I haven't heard her do a thing about it. She's too interested in the politics of the presidential election.
Well, maybe we need to bring this out and put a challenge out to Sarah Palin to step up.
I think that it needs to go viral, and we need to flood Sarah's emails and mailbox with exactly this. And I think that we need to flood our state government, our governor and the legislature, with demands that we recover those islands that were given away by Obama.
Any petition drives going?
I've not heard of one, but I think it would be a very worthwhile cause. Maybe I should try to start one.
I kind of hate to shift subjects, but I'm curious myself if you could give us an update on anything you might know about our friend Mr. Cox.
Mr. Cox is not gone to trial at this point. There has been a lot of legal wrangling. I've got some information that I can send you. It's rather old now, but the state has stepped out of the show completely.
I'm aware of that.
It is just federal demands, federal charges, and I think they're just going to keep him on ice until a year or two from now before they put him on trial.
What happened to speedy trial?
Doesn't exist on the federal plane. It's been a good year now.
Well, Gene, stay on with us. I've got another caller I want to get to, but I appreciate you coming on and appreciate you giving us all your feedback. And I think we need to work on, just like we've been working on the Klamath River with Kurt, I think we need to pick up this this situation with these islands is another situation where we can really demonstrate the federal tyranny and how they're stepping all over the rights of the state of Alaska. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a state and it's got a constitution. And from my understanding is that all the states have the equivalent rights according to federal law that was put in place. And I'll research that a little bit and send you some information on it. Stay with us, Gene. Don't go away. We're going to leave you live.
I'm just going to mute the phone.
Area code 321, you have a live mic.
Hi, Terry. This is Dan O'Brien. How are you doing?
Doing great, Dan. Doing really good.
First time I've called in, I think, to your radio show here. I want to say hi to Dr. Kate and Kirk McKenzie. I've been corresponding on occasion with Kirk. I have a specific question. Well, first off, let me compliment Kirk McKenzie on his plan. Of course, this one is very close to my heart. I've been focused on the county all along as the place to try to gain leverage that we need. But anyhow, at the county, I'm wondering I don't think we have the protection that we are supposed to get from our government for our unalienable rights. I sent a letter recently to Red Beckman, and that was to order a book, but I don't know if you got the letter or not, but I've asked this question of him. Maybe you or Kirk have the answer to, do we need to install a missing common law jurisdiction in our counties to gain the kind of protection that we need as a group? So far, all I've seen in the way of success is that individuals at times can succeed in the commercial courts to avoid their jurisdiction, but and I think that in order to gain the power that we really need to clean up our county, we have to have our own courts, common law courts. So am I correct on that or not? I'm wondering if maybe you or Kirk could answer that, or either that or just entertain the question.
Well, Red is also listening, and I just got the opportunity to visit with Red and was aware that you'd sent him a letter. Appreciate your writing him. And he spent some time in a dentist chair this afternoon, so he's not intending to try to speak tonight. I don't think he's any shape to do that. But Red, if you are, you're certainly welcome to jump in, because I don't know if you've got a live mic right now or not, but I'm sure Kate will give you one. Dan, I need to understand more clearly what your question is, if you could be very concise about your question.
My question. Well, it seems that we have a government that is strictly a commercial government, that you have to be a fiction in order to be in their jurisdiction, and they presume that you are a fiction when you go to the courts. And nothing in the fiction does not have unalienable rights. So in order to stand as a man, not under contract, not a government employee or anything else like that, but to have the power of some jurisdiction that we can fall back on. Well, a good example is, okay, if you get a traffic ticket, the only thing you can do, you go to traffic court, you are in that commercial jurisdiction, and they're going to get their pound of flesh. And I would think that habeas corpus or some other means that we could, if we had a common law jurisdiction in that same county that the people themselves put together, that we could handle, you know, we'd find out, well, there's no victim in this case. You know, a person was just traveling along and was cited. And, you know, that if we got them over in the common law court, that we could get rid of that ticket. But that's a simplified explanation. I think that a lot of people being injured, well, I think Kirk mentioned a lot of cases just in this conversation tonight about how people are being injured by the federal or state government or just the laws, statutes, and so forth that don't apply to us. How do we get out from underneath the statutes? And I think that a common law jurisdiction is the answer, but maybe I'm dead wrong on that.
Well, Dan, you are who you declare yourself to be, or if you are represented, who your representation declares you to be. The minute you set foot into court and you have representation, you are in essence a corporation. That's what Red has spent a lot of time, and I'm sure he'll be writing to you about this. He spent a lot of time trying to educate us on what he considers the most powerful and most important of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights, and that is the Seventh Amendment, or the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights.
I'm familiar with that.
Where you can, in any case where there's a dispute between you and the government of $20, $25 or more, whatever it is, that you can go in pro persona, not pro se. You can't represent yourself. You have to go in as yourself. You go in pro persona. You go in there and you declare that judge to be a government agent, not capable of making an impartial decision because he's a government agent, refusing, stating that he is not capable of making a finding of fact or a determination of law, and demand a common law grant, a jury, a common law jury. Then you have set a common law court. And by doing that, you take the judge out of the position of basically judging the law, and you put that jury in the position of judging the law. But you got to go in there as yourself.
Well, let me explain something that happened then. This summer, I received a seatbelt infraction. Didn't wear my seatbelt. I'm not wearing a seatbelt. So, I decided, well, this is happening too much. I could use this as a test case. And I went to Christian Law and did a clean abatement. Are you familiar with that? Where I said, well, I'm not questioning this on the merits. I'm questioning this on where's the contract, you know, that makes me subject to having to wear this seatbelt, because just a number of other questions that are involved in there. And they gave them 20 days to respond. If they didn't respond, then I find them in default of that, and that would dismiss the ticket. So anyhow, they didn't respond. However, they did process the ticket. And when I didn't pay this fine, they sent me a notice that my license would be suspended. And meanwhile, I got another seatbelt infraction, but that's another story. So then I ignored all this because I felt, well, you know, this plea and abatement suspended the license or found them in default, and so that dismissed the case, dismissed the infraction in both cases. Well, I was a month later driving back home from Jacksonville and got stopped for speeding, and they found out that my license, in fact, had been suspended, and this led to a criminal case, and so they had me. They set a court date for me. Well, I immediately wrote another plea in abatement on that suspension and saying, you know, this is wrong, you know. And so I always on the strength of these pleas in abatement, which are a common law device, I believe, done with Christian law terms and terminology and so forth, they didn't honor them, and they didn't inform me that they didn't honor them. So they're in dishonor. And I can't do a damn thing about it because they're the only jurisdiction in town. So when I missed the criminal court date, then 3 days later on a bench warrant, I was arrested. Spent a night in jail. I thought, I better get out of here. So I paid the bond, and they rescheduled my court date. So I thought, well, this time I have to go. So when I went into court, after a little while, the judge started calling names to have people come through the swing gate in bar and sit down in what would otherwise be a jury box. When he called my name, I tried to do exactly what you were saying. And he said, shut up and sit down over here. And so, you know, there was a little discussion with him. It was obvious I'm not going to get my way. And I didn't want him to get his way because I didn't want to be in his jurisdiction. So I turned around, started leaving. And he sent a deputy after me. He put me in a holding cell for a couple hours while I took care of other business. And then they got around to me and said, well, you got three choices, you know, the three pleadings. it doesn't work. They're getting way out of hand.
Well, Dan,
and I don't know.
In these local jurisdictions like that, it's you've got to pretty much deal with what the local law is. I mean, you can't try to go in on a case where a speeding ticket, for example, and ask for a jury trial when that's prohibited in the rules of procedure in that local area. I mean, it's a battle not worth hassling over. You really got to be somewhat careful about choosing your battles, and you got to go in the right way to start with. But if you're gonna drive without a license, for example, you better not be speeding. I mean, you're asking for it if you do that.
I didn't even know it was suspended. Why would I assume it was suspended? They said they would suspend it if I didn't pay the fine, and I didn't pay the fine. But I was never notified that it was suspended. But anyway, this is not a small.
Well, I was having a little trouble understanding you because you're. I don't know if it's your mic or what, but the question is anybody hearing me now?
yeah, I'm hearing you.
Good.
Well,
I thought my Skype dropped. Good.
Okay. So,
Kurt,
my question,
do you have anything to contribute to that question?
I'm asking, do we need common law jurisdiction?
I think that the, first off, on the traffic ticket thing, you know, hey, we got to pick bigger fights. And secondarily, we've got to stop this mentality of fighting them alone. You know, I think before you do anything, you've got to have a team of people working together. And, you know, we're all a bunch of loners, but we've got to get used to working in teams. As far as the common law things goes, I think that the, as I've said to many people I've talked to on this whole sovereignty issue, is for me what's lacking is that 13-page white paper, kind of like Gull Gerbenson, where you lay out in a logical fashion with enough citations to be credible the whole argument that people want to make about the sovereignty question. It doesn't help the movement that there's, you know, I talk to 10 people, I get 10 different opinions, and everybody's quite convinced that they have the right viewpoint of this and everybody else is wrong. So I think that that has not yet occurred. I think, personally, I think we're on a lot firmer ground to try and approach the problem from the following perspective, which is to get the people educated in the Constitution and adopt the idea that when we make judgments, that we are the judges. This is the way the Constitution's, you know, the judge there is nothing but a clerk. I mean, they're like a referee. They're supposed to make sure that the thing happens according to a set of rules, but they are not the judges. The jurors are the judges. And if the jurors begin to just adopt a common sense approach to these decisions and make particularly the issues where it's the state is going after the individual and basically make a decision based upon certain principles, is this an action that benefits the people? You know, those kind of simple questions, I think we're going to do a lot better.
Okay. I guess my question is, I don't think we have common law jurisdiction by way of the commercial courts. I think it's an oxymoron to say that we do. And I'm thinking that we need to establish our common law jurisdiction, the protection of our rights. We don't have a government that protects us as a man and a woman. We have a government that protects us, if you want to call it protection, as a fiction, the fiction that they create with our name, the fiction that they cite on a traffic thing, the fiction that gives them control of our children and so forth.
I understand the whole argument, Dan, you know, and I have had some really long and good discussions. I'm just saying I think that the quicker path to getting what you want to do is if you have jurors who understand the Constitution, the principles behind our nation, and make decisions on the basis of that, whether you have the kind of common law court that we should have or don't have, the jurors do make the decision. They could declare you innocent.
Okay. How do you get to a jury? I mean, I'm finding out that that's not even possible. First, you have to... I'm not even sure how this works, you know. I think, like, on a traffic citation, first you're supposed to pay the fine. Or if you don't pay the fine, then you say, well, I want to go to court. When you go to court, they say, well, it's a traffic court. You just talk to an administrator. Maybe it's
the first thing, I wouldn't even waste my time on a traffic court violation. This is not the battleground, in my opinion. I would rather fight an issue has to do with, for example, jurisdiction over federal lands than I would try to fight a
ticket. Sure, I understand that.
A ticket.
I understand that.
Right. And if I'm going to fight an issue like federal jurisdiction, then I want to make sure that there's a foundation, a core group of people that are pretty well educated, understand the constitutional issues, and understand the topic. I do believe you know, it's pretty hard here in the San Francisco Bay Area to reach out and start to educate, you know, I don't know how many people we have in Santa Clara County, but it's hundreds of thousands, if not millions. I mean, it's an impossible task. But, you know, Siskiyou County has 44,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that there's counties that are, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people or something. You know, the lower population density works against them in that they don't have the money, the budgets, the critical mass, and so forth. But it works for them in that it's a hell of a lot easier to reach a tipping point in one of these counties, particularly when the reservoir of values is already there.
Well, Dan, I'm glad you called in. We've got a couple other callers I want to try to get to here. We've got area code 724 that's live.
Hi, Terry. It's Dwayne.
Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, listen, Red, don't feel so bad. Dennis had two teeth pulled this week, too, so I know the feeling. But if he's still listening, I wanted to address what Dan's talking about, and I'm familiar with what I think I know what he's trying to say there. We've tried successfully in a lot of interesting ways, whether you've got a jury trial or if you've just got a judge on a bench. If you go into the courtroom with a lot of friends wearing, like, don't tread on me shirts, passing out the miniature constitutions as you go in with smiles and happy, polite attitudes, and when you go in, you show you have a great presence of people that can't wait to see how this court carries out, it makes the judge nervous. It makes the bailiff nervous. It makes the whole court system want to sit up straight, put their feet planted, you know, straight on the floor, and they fold their hands like they would in school. We had one case up here in Pennsylvania where there was a railroad being done to a fellow friend of ours, and we knew it was a railroad job, and so there was a guy was trying to sue this guy, and he had ties to the judge. Well, we decided, we got about 24 people together, Ron Paul shirts, don't tread on me shirts, you name it, and we went in very peacefully, very smilingly, and passing out miniature constitutions to people, and we sat like, we're just the happiest crowd to be there, just sitting there with a big smile on our face, can't wait to see how this real court system really works in this area. And that judge looked at all of us that just marched into that room, and we all sat down peacefully, just stared, like waiting for it to happen. He looked around, and you could see the fear in his eyes. He called both of the attorneys in his chamber. They came out about 3 minutes later. He said, this case is dismissed. That's all he said, and that was it. Not a thing was said. And even even in just a simple situation like that, no jury trial that was, it was just a judge on a bench, that just the presence of people can create a common law atmosphere, Dan. And so if you've got a lot of friends, don't be afraid to take them with you. Like, that's what I'm trying to say. I've seen a lot of that happen up here.
Well, Dwayne, I agree. It's very important to get a bunch of people watching what's going on. And I totally agree with what Kurt said a while ago. I want to come back to you in a second, Dwayne. Hang in here. Did you hear what Kurt said at the beginning of the show, Dwayne?
I came in about 10 minutes after.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping you heard what he said, what I was referring to, because it was right down your alley, and I'd like to get your feedback on it. Let me get this other caller in real quick, and we'll come back to you. Area code 317, you're live.
Yeah, have you guys ever heard of the Free State Project?
I'm not sure I heard what you said.
Have you ever heard of the Free State Project?
The Free State Project?
Yes, sir.
I've heard of it. I'm not sure that I know exactly what it is.
Well, basically, I'm hearing a lot of the same things here, and they're trying to get a lot of people moved up to New Hampshire, where the overall population is so low that a small portion of people would be able to make a big difference.
Okay, so this is a particular project in New Hampshire?
Well, they're inviting people to move there, actually, yeah. Like libertarians, basically.
So who's behind this, and what exactly are they trying to focus on?
Well, it's just the freestateproject.org, and they're just trying to get free of the tyrannical government, sir.
Basically a John Galt community.
Right.
Sure. But he was saying, where do you get your jurors? And, you know, the solution is you have to build an educated, well-informed, and armed society, which we're kind of getting away from.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure how it works on a national scale. Thanks for calling in and telling us about that. We'll check that out. Dwayne?
Yes.
Did you hear Kurt talking about going back to the Bible?
Oh, yes. I did hear that part, yeah. That was quite interesting.
You're not coming through very clearly, Dwayne. If you could speak as clear as you can in that mic, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I did hear his comments on the Bible. Was there something in particular that you wanted me to comment on?
Well, I just thought that was touching near and dear to your heart, and I thought maybe you would want to comment on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'd be happy to, but let me first say that, yeah, Kirk, I sent you and Kirk, too, also, by the way, a message. I talked to a sheriff's secretary here in Pennsylvania today who's I send you each an email, and you guys can take a look at it. If you guys could contact her, she's got some great inroads to this constitutional sheriff we have here now. So, but she's when I got on the phone, she said, "Bless you." I said, "Wow, I like this gal." Okay, so yeah, this is the kind of stuff that just brings my heart towards the forefront, that there is a lot of hope left in this country, and the few of us that still do understand the concept, like Kirk said, you have to go back to the Bible. Even the Magna Carta is a wonderful document as it is, but everything always goes back to the Bible. That's the unalienable right. Unalienable meaning not transferable from God to government. And the way I read it anyway. And then like Kirk says, and you go back to the original Black Law dictionaries and not the ones that they're using now, and you get some more accurate descriptions. I would say that what Kirk was saying was very true. It is principled, and principles based on the Bible. I would add that to what Kirk was saying, principles based on the Bible, though. Not just principles in general, but principles based on Scripture. Because without those, well, let's say you go by the initial 10 principles, the 10 commandments. A commandment without a penalty is what? A suggestion. Since every commandment has a penalty, it's not a suggestion. It's a real commandment. And then those create the principles by which we go by. And now, Terry, you and I have talked before about the Center of Constitutional Studies and the Dr. Earl Taylor and his 28 principles with the 5,000-year leap. I disagree a little bit with the 28 principles just because of some biblical problems I have there. But like Kirk says, if we get back to the Bible and use that as our foundation and then build everything else off of that, we'll be right back to where we started from. And I do agree with Kirk that we have to start not with a federal repair job, but you start with a sovereign individual under a sovereign creator. Like you say, we've got this pecking order you and Red talk about all the time. A sovereign individual under a sovereign creator, that sovereign individual then creates an assembly of people around him, becoming a town, a county, then a state, and then you work up to the federal level. But the federal level is just as what originally it was, right, just your national level. Even the Bible, you would gather people together, even all the... A lot of people don't know this, but even all the registration in Scripture was done at a local level. You never had registrations done on a national level, even in Israel or Judah, any of the Old Testament nations. It was still done on a local level. If you wanted to know who was in certain towns, you had to go to that town to find out. The Fed for the national people did not hold all those records. And I think that was another interesting part, too. You did a census. Even in the Roman Empire, the census didn't even ask who is who. All they did was a head count. So when you realize that you keep it small, and you start at counties and you work your way out, so the power remains in the small groups. They then counter-check one another. So all that I believe strongly is based in Scripture. I mean, if you want to get you the Scriptures for that too, but it is all out of. The 5, 10, 50, and 100s that Jethro gave to Moses in the book of Exodus. So I don't know how much further you wanted me to go with that, but yeah, I was very impressed with what Kurt was saying there. It was very well said, Kurt.
Well, let me add some thoughts to this, because I probably differ with most people on this particular point. The way I like to do this is that I think that we are really at a crossroads here. And there are a ton of people that are in this movement that believe in the principles, but they don't believe in God. They don't believe that Jesus was the Son of God or God. They don't believe religion, but they, you know, they may not even know where their values come from, but they do believe in life. They do believe in liberty. You know, they have all the beliefs, but not necessarily the acknowledgement of the religion. And I believe religion consists of three things: whether you believe in God, whether you believe in church as a representative of God, or whether you believe in the values. I think we're at a point where we just have to get to the fundamental values. And I don't feel it necessary, in my viewpoint, to try and convince anybody that God exists or that Jesus Christ was anything other than just a man. The message I try and convey to people, regardless of whether you believe in that or you don't believe in that, he is the historical source of this message. And it begins not in the Old Testament, it's in the New Testament. If you want to understand our principles, you have to go to the New Testament. Christianity begins with Christ. There's a reason it's called the New Testament, because it outdates the Old Testament. And so there's a message that he's giving that's not in the Old Testament. And that's where the principles come from. I personally, and I probably differ with a lot of people that listen to the show, and I know probably Terry and Red and everybody else, is I believe we have to reach a common, we are at such a precipice at this point in time, that we have to, I think, see if we can even just get an agreement on the principles. You know, I'm not sure that we have a majority that do, but I do believe that the battle we have to engage in is not to just say, well, that's constitutional or not constitutional, because people are already writing that off. I mean, we have lost so many people. I think we have to get down to the basic underlying concepts and see if we got a majority that agree to those concepts anymore. I believe that majority exists, but I believe it exists and it can survive independent of a message that you have to be a Christian or that you have to believe in God. I realize I differ from people in this, but that's where I come from. So I think those values can be expressed, and whether you believe that, you know, that human life is valuable because that we are the children of God, or if you just believe, well, you don't believe that, but you believe that nonetheless, you believe that humans are somehow exceptional and that every human life matters, we got to the same point. And I think that's where we have to get to personally, is get back to some common core set of values that a majority, and I think 70 or 80% of the people would agree to. I don't think people come to this country from communist Russia or communist China, you know, believe that, you know, that socialism or communism is the way to go. I think they believe that, you know, they want to have the American dream. So I think if we get down to the core value set, and that's why in How to Take Our Country Back, I acknowledge the source of that. I think I don't mind telling anybody the source of that, but if you don't agree with me on that belief, that's not a problem for me, but let's talk about that those values.
Well, let me interject a little bit, Kurt. You know, I haven't probably read and studied the Bible quite as much as Duane has, but I've done my share. I've taught my way through the scriptures a couple of times, and it's kind of hard to do that without reading the whole thing. One of the things that I've discovered in reading a lot of secular information is that the things that are true are in that scripture. They're in the Bible. And again, it doesn't matter who you believe in or whether you believe in the hereafter or that God is the creator. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about practical, logical things that work, that are truth. I don't believe that. I'm a complete, total believer in God and Yeshua, his son. But when I look at scripture, I recognize that it's not true because God said it. God says it because it's true. It works. It's logical. It makes sense. And just based on that alone, I've had some conversations with some atheists about this, and they really couldn't argue with me. It was a good motivation for them to go back and read the scripture, which, you know, was sort of my ploy. But my point was that the Bible lines up with science. It lines up logically. And people who think that God just said these things or put these principles forward because they were his idea, they don't get it. Those principles are there because they are functional, practical principles that make sense for us. It's just like instituting the Sabbath, which Duane is one of the most experts on that I know of. He instituted the Sabbath not for him, but for us, for the people. Right, Duane?
Yeah, the Sabbath was created for man, not for the Father, yeah. It's for our appointed time with him. Yeah, exactly.
So I guess what I'm saying is that I totally agree with what you're saying from a practical perspective, Kurt. Forget about the fact that I'm a Christian. Forget about the fact that I know God exists, that I trust in him as the sovereign that has, and I would not want to have gotten my unalienable rights from any place else. Forget about all of that. It just makes sense, and those principles make sense. They're good things to live by, and they work. That's what our initial laws and our initial constitution, all of those were based on biblical principles. So is that a reaffirm what you're saying, Kurt? Because
I think you're saying the same thing I am. I think there's a place where we can meet with people who don't have to believe in God or don't have to believe in Christianity or whatever else, but we can meet on a set of values. And I think that's really where we have to at this point in time. And I think that it would be, seems to me, that we would get a majority of people who believe in the human, you know, has a right to live. You know, everybody has a right to live, you know. It seems to me that's a value that we can all embrace, that human life is valuable. And I think that's the kind of meeting ground. And so when you watch How to Take Our Country Back, you'll see me give recognition to the source of those. I think there is no question as to the source of those. But I will quickly then move into the values themselves and talk to the values. And I've given my ideas of what I think the core value set is. I show how that value set drives your perspective of government, results in your belief in what government should look like. How do you then have to compare what government is compared to what it should be? And then you have to have a strategy. You have to have a game plan. You have to know where the hell you're going. And you have to go on the offense. You can't win, score on the defense. So you have to have a plan. There's no plan in the Tea Parties. You know, you have to understand enough about the world to know where the hell, and about the opposition to know what you've got to do and where to go do it. And then once you have that, you have a set of tactics. And then once you have a set of tactics, you have to implement. So to me, the whole in Defend Rural America project is an implementation of the master scheme. And it has to do in there with property rights and so forth that I do talk about. We have to defeat Agenda 21, for example. We have to defeat the central bankers. I mean, there's some fundamental goals that we have to achieve if we're going to get our liberty and our country back. But this whole solution has, you know, I don't know, 10 layers to it. I mean, you have to deal at every layer, so you have to be able to understand the value set at one level, the enemy at another level. You've got to understand how to bring it down to reality and get traction on the street. And ultimately, you know, I went to college back in the 60s when things were pretty heated up on campuses, and I remember very clearly some slogans which I now believe have some validity to. I didn't believe them at the time, but one of those is lead, follow, or get out of the way. And another one is action is supreme. You know, we have too much paralysis by analysis in this movement, and people will get stuck in just wanting to get educated, and they don't go any further. Well, no problem with education. I am perpetually learning from people, but there has to be an action plan. And, you know, if all you do is continue to listen and learn and not getting off and doing stuff, well, you're part of the problem. So I agree with Terry that you have to consolidate around those that got it. They're prepared to do something, and they're either going to lead or follow. They have to take one of those two positions, and let's get on with it. Let's get united. The biggest part of the problem in this movement is trying to figure out how the hell to create unity out of what is inherently a disorganized mess. That's the challenge.
Dwayne, I want to give you 1 minute, and then I want Kurt to take the last 2 minutes to wrap this up.
Sounds good. Yeah, I just. I really believe, though, that Kurt, you've got everything going for you. I've got a lot of confidence that your heart's in the right place and everything. I just find out that there is a creator. That creator is insisting on making sure that those who want to be blessed by him do their very best to keep idolatry out of the land. Every instance you see in Scripture where the land is blessed, The leadership and the people are co-jointly making sure that there's no idolatry or no other god worship in their land. You're allowed to have strangers pass through your land or whatnot, and you can find some of that in Romans chapter 13. Give tribute unto tribute who is due, custom to whom custom. That's, I think, Romans 13:7 or something. But the picture is that, bottom line, that the Father blesses a nation who follows his laws, and part of that law is to keep other gods out. The other gods, basically, have other tenets, principles, commandments. So when you're following the Father's laws, the Bible's laws, you're going to be blessed. And it can still lead back to just principles, but you have to follow them. In other words, homosexuality wouldn't fit. Or worshiping Allah won't fit, because those laws are opposite or diametrically opposed in a lot of ways to the Scriptures. And I'll call it a night there. Thanks, guys.
Kurt, you're down to a minute and a half. I did have one question from one of our chat people wanting to know how people can punch into the Siskiyou surge. In other words, how can they participate or help with what's going on in Siskiyou County?
Well, go to defendruralamerica.com, and you're going to find a relatively short but absolutely information-packed website, highly visual. There's lots of video. There's lots of photographs. There's a lot of audio, not a lot of pages. I mean, it's everything is very short. It's to the point. It's very high value. And if you live in rural America, if you don't live in rural America, at least watch a video about Siskiyou County. Get some drift. You know, browse through a few of those pages. Look at the woes. Read a little bit about the Endangered Species Act. I mean, get a feeling for what's going on. If you want to help, go to the last page. I think it's get involved. There's an a strategy going on here, and it's all developing on that page. And so that entire website is giving you the content to support the strategy. And so you can go there, and you'll see links to my videos, the monetary system videos. There's three of those. There's two on the Defend Rural America. And email me, let me know, get involved on the mailing list as a minimum, and help me to expand the communication channel.
Thank you a lot, Kurt, and I'll be talking with you. We'll be moving forward on all this stuff, and I believe I've got most people's contact information. If you need to email me, you can send it to tcdodd@q.com, and I'll be glad to plug you in to anything that we've got going on, as long as I know who you are. Thanks, Kate. Thank you, Red. I know you're listening. Thanks, Wayne.
What would happen if we prayed for those raised up to lead the way? Then maybe kids in school could play and unborn children see light of day. What if the life that we pursue came from a hunger for the truth? What if the family turned to Jesus, stopped asking Oprah what to do? What if his people prayed? And those who bear his name would only think.